We are back once again, 302nd episode of the Parish of the Patriots. And as always, I'm glad you've joined me here for today's show. I do know most of you are return members of the congregation. That says something, and I do appreciate you. If you are new, first time tuning in and listening, I hope you'll stick through the whole thing. I will tell you, we do have a Christian-specific segment, sort of a sermon, if you would. And that is roughly the halfway point of the show. I will let you know when we morph into that. I make a concerted effort not to get too preachy before that. So it causes you to have like an epileptic seizure if you hear those sorts of things, I will warn you so that the demons be not cast out of you. You can just keep cuddling with your demon. I'm just kidding. We have a lot of fun here, but I will let you know when we go into that. If you absolutely don't want to listen to that, you can skip it and just listen to the first part of the show. See, I do that for you. I do encourage you to give it a shot at least once. I think it'll be a little different than anything you've probably ever heard before. And so without out of the way, if you do get something out of the show, don't be shy. Pay those tithes. We have the ultimate privacy coin. We got snail mail. The address is right here on the description page for the show on Radio Albion. So we got the snail mail. Send those envelopes. It is always very much appreciated. So with that said, we get right into it. And see, you get to be in the listener supporter mailbag. Mr. T, I'm trying not to cough here. I didn't get choked up on my coffee. I don't know what I got going on here. So we're going to soldier our way through it. Mr. T, I got two from you this week. I'm doing this show. This is one of those weeks I'm recording the show on the day that it'll air. So I checked my mail a little later than I usually do. So Mr. T, I got you down twice. So next week's show, I'm sure there won't be one. Don't think it got lost somewhere. So I got you twice with your dough for the show. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do my Elvis impression.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
GPD, well, I'm not being shy and paying them tithes. Thank you very much, Peter. No questions this week, but if this letter manages to arrive on time, I'd like to wish you and the listeners all a Merry Christmas. Dio Optimo Maximo, and that is from Peter. Thank you very much, Peter. We will have one more show. I was just looking at the calendar this morning, and the next show will be on Christmas Eve. Isn't that special? We will have a show up, too, by the way. We will have a show up on Christmas Eve. So, yeah, that's going to be, no doubt, that'll be a fun, special thing. So, thank you very much. And that's it. That gets us through the listener supporter mailbag this week. And once again, I do very much appreciate it. Now, as you all will know, I've stated that we are at this point. That to figure out who wields the power in this country, I mean, you have to be either clinically retarded or just willfully not look at it, because it is in your face. And as such, as I've said, I don't care to talk about it very much, because I mean, how do you not get it? It's like if I sat here and did a show on the air we breathe or the sun being warm, we're at this point of obviousness. And yet, with that having been said, we're going to talk about this today a little bit, because I saw a really blatant example of this a couple of days ago. I was out somewhere and they had a TV on, and it was on mute, so I didn't get the particulars, but they had the subtitle, they had the captions on. And I believe it was a politician up in Yankee land. They were going on about the drones, and this politician, I think it was the governor, but don't hold me to that. Anyway, he came out to do a press conference on the mystery drones. And I'm watching this, reading the subtitle, because he comes out to do his press conference, but he spends the first like half of the press conference going on about how the legislature in that state, I believe is New Jersey, definitely needs to pass this anti-Semitism legislation. What the hell that has to do with drones, I have no idea. But he comes out to supposedly answer questions about the drones, and instead he goes on, he's making it a point to go on and on about how the legislature absolutely must enact this legislation concerning anti-Semitism. I chuckle, because it's like I'm sitting here chuckling to myself, because I'm thinking, is this guy implying that the drones are somehow connected to the Jews? Is that what he's implying? Of course, that's not what he was implying, but it was just so silly because it was so out of place. This has nothing to do with the other. And yet he makes it a point to stand up there and do this whole public cry about how the legislature needs to pass this anti-Semitism legislation. Now, what a lot of this legislation comes down to here in the U.S., I realize those of you over in bizarro places such as Britain and different European countries, y'all have even harsher laws. What they're pushing right now is this adopting this definition of anti-Semitism from the IHRA, this pushing this official recognition of this definition of anti-Semitism from the IHRA. And it's been passed in a lot of places. They passed this here in Texas several years ago. And what I thought we'd do today is actually look at some of this definitions that have been officially adopted and why it matters. Because this isn't what we have so far at this point, isn't some sort of like Great Britain or European model of you go to prison for questioning anything or bringing up anything about the Jews. This is just simply adopting this working definition because you have to have these committees and they have to have a definition of the anti-Semitism because it is such a pressing problem. Because again, when you have politicians come out and they're supposed to be talking about something completely unrelated, like drones, and they just take this weird, it just struck me as strange. Well, it's not strange because but they take that opportunity to do this whole ham-handed appeal about anti-Semitism. This has nothing to do with drones. I don't know of anybody that are saying the Jews are operating these drones over New Jersey. So if I was a reporter and I was there, I would ask him, what the hell does that have to do with drones? Are you implying that the Jews are running these drones? Because I don't know of anybody who's made that accusation. And yet he goes out here and does this whole public thing. Maybe he's anticipating that people are going to say, I don't know. But I thought, let's just look over this. Look over this working definition that they're using and talk a little bit about where I think they're going, why they're put, because like I say, this is non-binding for the moment. This is just a definition. They're having hearings, committee hearings, discussions. Now I'm using the Texas government's website for this. I'll try to remember to link it up in the description show so you can go through. It's not a long web page, but we're gonna use this as official documentation. We use their official sources. And it says here, contemporary examples of anti-Semitism in public life, the media, schools, the workplace, and in the religious sphere could, taking into account the overall context, include, but are not limited to. Now we're going to go through some of these points. Number one, calling for, aiding, or justifying the killing or harming of Jews in the name of a radical ideology or an extremist view of religion. Now, they start right off the bat. I mean, this is pretty, I don't think anybody's going to have a problem if you're calling for killing people. I don't think anybody's really going to have a problem saying, yeah, that's it's pretty extreme. Pretty extreme. But see, as we go along, the waters be getting a little muddy right away. The next one, number two here, making mendacious, dehumanizing, demonizing, or stereotypical allegations about Jews as such, or the power of Jews as a collective, such as, especially, but not exclusively, the myth about a world Jewish conspiracy of Jews controlling the media, economy, government, or other societal institutions. So if you look at who owns the media, Hollywood, this is interesting because you can go to publications in Israel such as Haaretz, and there's articles about boasting about how much control they have, how they run Hollywood. There was an article written by a Jewish person sometime back, and I don't remember if it was in the Israeli media or here in the U.S., but you know, the article was titled basically, yes, we control Hollywood and we should stop hiding it. We should just be forthright about it, which I kind of agree with him on that. Why be subtle about it? Instead, you know, when you can just look at documentation of the percentage of ownership compared to the percentage of the population, I think it's a little mendacious, to use their term, to make this claim that it's just a complete conspiracy theory that they wield this power. We already know that the most powerful lobby in the U.S. is the Israel lobby. That is, again, a documented fact, but in this section of this definition of anti-Semitism, if you point out this, absolutely, I mean, the government's own documentation of political action committee contributions, the Israel lobby is 100% the most powerful lobby in the country. Many of you have probably seen that TikTok video where somebody's in the halls of Congress and they're like, you know, welcome to the Congress of Israel or something like that. And they go through and all of these offices, every one of them have identical I stand with Israel placards on the doors. And yet, if you look at this and observe this and look at the government's own statistics, does this mean the government's campaign contribution statistics are anti-Semitic by documenting what the most powerful lobby in the country? You see, you already are getting off into this, into these murky waters. Are the government's own statistics then anti-Semitic? Go to the next point. Accusing Jews as a people of being responsible for real or imagined wrongdoings committed by a single Jewish person or group, or even for acts committed by non-Jews. Now, this gets into the micro versus the macro. And you always get into this if you get into racial discussions, regardless of what group of people you're talking to. If somebody will count, you'll say these group of people as a racial group tend towards this type of behavior. And again, it's irrelevant what the racial group we're talking about is. And somebody will come back and say, well, they're not all like that. Well, yeah, nobody's saying they're all like that. You're talking about as a group, they tend to do these. Because everybody does. I mean, as a group. I mean, even if you get into the different white groups, you know, the Irish tend to be a certain way. The English tend to be certain. Germanic people tend to be a certain way. Black people tend to be a certain way. They have racial characteristics. That's what makes them a different racial group. That's what makes these different groups of people. And you can talk about this on the macro scale, but only an idiot thinks they're not individual people who are different from that group. Now, they say individual people or group, how big is the group? Because they throw first the individual people. You know, you shouldn't blame the whole group for what one person does. Well, yeah, I mean, that's common. That's common sense. You know, again, if you understand micro versus macro, but then they also throw in right after that, or group, which leads the question of, well, how big of a group are we talking about? If it's a group of five people, then, well, yeah, you can't point to the actions of a group of five people and say, yeah, they're all like that. But if the group is thousands of people, then you've blurred the line between the micro and the macro. There's always individual people make their own individual. They do their own thing. But again, that doesn't discount the fact that you can look at people as a group of people, again, no matter what the group is, and say, well, they have a tendency to do this sort of thing. Next up, denying the fact scope mechanism, though we're going to have some fun with this, i.e. gas chambers, or intentionality of the genocide of the Jewish people at the hands of National Socialist Germany and its supporters and accomplices during World War II, otherwise known as the Holocaust. The mechanisms. Now, and the scope. We're going to go through each one of these. So basically denying anything about the Holocaust. Let's start with the scope. How are you not allowed to deny the scope? Because the scope keeps changing. Remember, the numbers at Auschwitz keep being revised around. You know, 6 million was thrown out there for all this time, and now that number has been revised around. And depending on which historical documentation you look at, that number varies. But you're not allowed to question that. The next one's a biggie, mechanisms. You're not allowed to question or deny the mechanisms. And we all have our favorites, my personal being the roller coaster. And they were packed in the roller coaster and it went down and slammed into a wall and they flew out of the cars into the giant furnace there, which burned them up. Another second favorite for many are the eagle and the bear in the cage, and you're put into the cage with the eagle and the bear. There's many. You're not allowed to question this or it's anti-Semitic. Now, come on now. Over the years, I've jokingly said that instead of having these groups doing this, you know, promoting this sort of nonsense, the Jews should really just pay me to like give them some advice, because this is so silly. You're not allowed to question any of this. Roosters crowing in the tree. I mean, there's so many just laughably absurd Holocaust stories that just then come out and say, well, you're not allowed to question any of that. I think before you were going to go out and push something like this, you should come out and say, okay, look, some of these stories are a little out of hand. And some of these survivors got a little carried away. Start reeling some of that back in. See, if they were paying me to give them some, to be a consultant, I would be like, okay, look, y'all need to start, before you start trying to push something like this, you need to start reeling some of these absurd stories in. When people bring up the roller coaster of flying into the ovens, and you say, no, that's not true. That needs to be, and they did, they have done this to a certain extent. I mean, when I was a kid growing up, turned into bars of soap was an absolute fact. Again, if this definition was working, you wouldn't be allowed to deny or question it. But today, they say, no, Jews were not actually rendered into bars of soap. That is not true. The human skin lampshades. It's funny because you run into some of this stuff. And some of it, depending on who you're referencing, you know, you look at one deal and they say, no, it's absolutely true. You're not allowed to question it. But then you look at other source materials and they will say, well, yeah, no, that didn't actually happen. In fact, some of that, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, and I think it's the human skin lampshade one. I believe it's the Simon Wiesenthal Center, which is obviously for the Holocaust. They changed that story up. Again, the human skin lampshades was told to us as gospel truth when I was a kid growing up. And then I believe it's the Simon Wiesenthal Center now says, no, that was a story designed by the Nazis to scare the Jews. And yet people will attack you and say, don't question the human skin. They haven't got the memo that no, the official narrative has shifted and changed. So you have this constantly shifting and changing narrative, but you're not allowed to question it because, again, this falls under this definition. So, again, if I was being advised, if they were paying me a consulting fee, I would be like, first, you need to reel this stuff in. Instead of coming out with something like this, you should come out with, okay, look, we've done a study, and these are the facts separated by the fiction. I would tell them, focus on the fact that Jews were isolated into these camps, because nobody can deny that. That's an absolute historical fact. I don't know of any quote-unquote Holocaust denier that denies these people were isolated and put into these camps. You get into, curiously, not all of them were, but we're not going to do that today. And then work from there. I would tell them, you know, parse out some of this stuff. You know, sit there and start separating and saying, okay, some of these stories have been exaggerated. Some of these stories are actually not correct. These numbers are not correct. And then you would add some legitimacy to it. Again, they're not paying me, so they wouldn't listen to me anyway. But that's what I would tell them to do. You need to start parsing this up, because when you just come out and say you're not allowed to question any of the mechanisms of this, and people read or hear about some of these, I mean, 100% absolutely absurd stories of roller coasters and eagles and bears and cages and all the rest of it. And instead of just saying, look, no, that's not true, then maybe somebody would be more apt to listen. But when you just lump all of this, you're not allowed to question any of it. I mean, that, yeah. Let's see here. Yeah, let's just go ahead and move on to the next one. Accusing the Jews as a people or Israel as a state of inventing or exaggerating the Holocaust. Well, I mean, their own numbers implied that there's been some exaggeration here. What I really find interesting about this particular one isn't necessarily the exaggerating the Holocaust part. It is here where they lump in Jews as a people or Israel as a state. Because in this line, they're putting the two together. Jews as a people or Israel as a state. Now, that becomes an important thing to keep in mind as we go through the rest of this, because here in this line, using this definition, it is they themselves, by this definition, which are lumping the two together, Jews as people or Israel as a state. Here they're putting the two together. The next one, accusing Jewish citizens of being more loyal to Israel or to the alleged priorities of Jews worldwide than the interests of their own nations. So when you look at the government statistics that show the most powerful lobby is Israel lobby, and you see there was a big hubbub here just recently. Some congressperson basically, you know, asked what was more important, the United States and Israel, and his response was essentially Israel. We've all, or most of you, probably seen that video clip of, I believe it was Nancy Pelosi sitting there once again at some forum for one of these lobby groups. And she basically said, if the United States is just completely collapsed, we would still support Israel no matter what. And you know, you look at that, and again, you're not even allowed to question why that is, why all this amount of power resides, and who's it being, it's being for the benefit, exercised, I'll get it spit out, exercised for the benefit of. Now, I don't believe you should have politicians should be allowed to hold office with dual citizenship of any country. That's not just singling out Israel. I don't think somebody should be able to be a congressman and be a dual citizen for, say, Venezuela and the United States, because being a dual citizen implies that you have dual loyalties. I mean, it's implied by the very topic that you're talking about. They have dual citizenship. It says here, Jewish citizens. Well, citizens of what? If they're strictly citizens of the United States, I can see where you could put that point out there. But what about the case of dual citizens? Because again, it doesn't matter what the foreign country is. If you have people that are dual citizens with China and the U.S., you know, but the implication here is that there's dual loyalties. Let's keep going through this. Denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination, e.g. by claiming the existence of the state of Israel, is a racist endeavor. Now, denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination. I don't think anybody should be denied their right to self-determination. I don't think anybody believes that. But then they lump that in with claiming the existence of the state of Israel is a racist endeavor. This runs into the wall of what we're told collectively. And this goes back to the one of collective blaming Jews as a group, because we're inundated with this all of the time. All white people, for instance, are somehow responsible for slavery, even though none of us ever owned any slaves. We're told that all European countries must be multicultural, otherwise it's racist and backwards. Then you have this flying in the face of Israel, which is defined by their own laws as an ethnic Jewish state. So the problem people run into with this is the double standard. You know, the double standard. You're going to, on the one hand, and people notice the overrepresentation of this group of people pushing this narrative of you have to be multi-ethnic because otherwise it's racist, are largely, a lot of the times, the same group of people saying, no, we have to have an ethnic Jewish state. And, you know, the you're just, I guess, not supposed to notice the contradiction here. When your narratives become this conflated, they become impossible to defend. If you look over, if you were around like I was back when apartheid South Africa existed and you looked at the amount of world pressure put on apartheid South Africa, it was an evil, racist state. And it had to be destroyed, and all this pressure was put on South Africa to destroy it. And yet the white people who were running South Africa never in a million years came close to treating the black people there the way the Palestinians are treated by the Israeli government. I mean, and there's nothing you can't, especially with what has happened in the past year. So there's no way to even make a remote comparison to that. The South African government did not go around carpet bombing black South African hospitals. I mean, that did not happen. You see, you run into this contradiction, and you're telling people they're not allowed to notice these contradictions or point them out. You tell people for years that unless a country is multicultural, then it's racist and evil. You told people and convinced them. You look at these different statues and you tell, you know, on the one hand earlier, you know, questioning any aspect of the Holocaust. Well, you can see what side of the kind of political spectrum they're aiming that at. Well, here with this, it's obviously aimed at the other side of that political spectrum. The people who really do believe white countries are racist and evil, but then they turn around and look at Israel and they say, well, these quote unquote white people in Israel are bombing the Palestinians and ethnically cleansing these people and genociding these people. So they have to have all these different points to address all these aspects of society. Again, if I was advising them, I would tell them before even coming close to putting something in this out, you need to start reeling your narratives in, and you need to start jettisoning some of these different claims and start trying to get a coherent message together, because this just comes across as we're just everybody in society is against us for no reason. We're almost through this. Let's keep going. Applying double standards by requiring of it a behavior not expected, that it being Israel, expected or demanded of any other democratic nation. I don't know any nation on the face of the earth right now that is bombing hospitals and refugee camps and apartment buildings. And if such a nation did such a thing, yes, there would be public outcry. It wouldn't be just like, well, we're only criticizing Israel for this behavior. For one thing, no one else is doing that behavior. It is only Israel that is doing this to these people. Nobody else is. And if somebody else was, it absolutely people would have a problem with it. Next up, using the symbols and images associated with classic anti-Semitism, e.g. claims of Jews killing Jesus or blood libel to characterize Israel or Israelis. Now, this gets back to what I said earlier. They made that conflation here in this. They purposely have conflated Jews and the state of Israel. You know, putting those two things together. And then they said, well, you're not allowed to put those two things together when it's they themselves who put those two things together. So if you make the claim of Jews killing Jesus to characterize Israel or Israelis. So if you make the claim of Jews killing Jesus, this is anti-Semitism. And yet there's Jews on record publicly. Yeah, we killed Jesus and we're glad we did. I mean, again, you can't square this circle. This is basically, it comes out when we get through this. It basically comes back to anything they don't like falls into this category. Next up, drawing comparisons of contemporary Israeli policy to that of the Nazis. I'll just leave that one floating out there. We're going to keep going. Holding Jews collectively responsible for actions of the state of Israel. And this is one I had in mind really particularly when, again, I said back up here, they're the one that said accusing the Jews as a people or the state or Israel as a state. They're conflating the two. They're saying there's essentially no separation because they put them together to cover that one whole thing. Now you get down to the last and it says, oh, well, you can't blame You can't equate the two together, but here in this very document, they're essentially equating the two together. How do you make a coherent argument here when there's some, you're contradicting yourself. Earlier you're saying the two are the same thing, and here you're saying, well, you can't say the two are the same thing. Now, Israel is an ethnic Jewish state. We've already covered that earlier. So that segment is conducting Israeli policy. I mean, that's whose country it is. That's the people the government is representing. And we see the actions the Israeli government is carrying out. So when you get into terms like collectively, how big of a collective are we talking about? Now, earlier I said, you know, they used the term groups. And I said, it depends on how big the group is. You can't say, yeah, all of them, because five people did something. But if you start talking about thousands or tens of thousands, you start talking about, well, maybe we are looking at, you know, something people as a group tend to do. Well, Israel is an ethnic Jewish nation. Earlier, complaining about that is anti-Semitic. If it is, and the Israeli government then represents that policy, if you're talking, in other words, collectively, if you're talking about the Israeli citizenship, then obviously the Israeli government is carrying out policy on behalf of that citizenship. So collectively that way. Now, if you're talking about worldwide, well, then no. There's Jews in the United States who are very much against Israeli policy. You know, again, it comes down to how big of a group are we talking about? You know, collectively is kind of a loose term. No one's saying every single Jew. There's plenty of Jews that are writing articles week in and week out condemning Israeli policy towards the Palestinian and indifferent Israeli policy. There's groups of Jews that don't even think the nation of Israel as it is today should even exist based on their own religious dogma or their own personal beliefs. So how big of a collective are we talking about? That's what is relevant here. And again, they just throw out this term collectively. But if you're talking about the Israeli citizen, the people that live in Israel, then absolutely, because they're not in the street demanding the overthrow of the government, that they stop ethnically cleansing the Palestinians. So obviously they're okay with Israeli policy. No, that doesn't mean every one of them worldwide, you know, because there's plenty of them worldwide that there are a number of them worldwide that don't agree with Israeli policy. Having gone through this, we have finished going through it. Like I said, it didn't take very long. This is observably a rhetorical document. This is not a legalistic document. This is not something that is founded in facts. All of those points we just went through are 100%. This is 100% pure rhetoric. There's no logic being applied. All of these things are appeals to emotion. That's why what I wanted to do going through these is to apply some logic here and to really look at it and say, what are we talking about? And time and again, what we see here is these are just emotional appeals. This is why at the end of the day, you're like, well, essentially, according to this document, anything they don't like is going to be labeled as anti-Semitism. It is a rhetorical document. Now, here in the U.S., we still have the window dressing of the First Amendment. It's fading fast along with, you know, any other semblance of rule of law. And, you know, this is a working definition. There's no teeth to it. And a lot of people misunderstand that when they hear about these things being passed. And they're like, oh, my gosh, they're passing European style, you know, anti-Semitism laws. You're going to get thrown in prison for saying anything. And that's not what this is. Because we still have the window dressing of the First Amendment. However, when you understand how things get put into place, they happen in steps. If they just came out and said, we're doing away with the First Amendment, and if you violate any of these things, this definition of anti-Semitism, you're going to go to prison, they would have a problem. But you see, they put it in, and people shrug their shoulders and say, well, okay, they can use whatever definition they want as long as, you know, they're not doing it. In other words, there's no teeth to this. But at some point, that will come about. At some point, you know, inevitably, you start with this, and then it's like, well, we have to have an enforcement mechanism, you see, and people will be used to it. Well, there'll be court challenge if that day comes, if and when, and I believe eventually probably will, you get enforcement of being in violation of these definitions of anti-Semitism. You can go to jail like in Europe, but of course there'll be court challenges, but we know how the courts operate in this country. Some judge will twist it all on its head and say, oh, well, this is this isn't in violation of the First Amendment. You see these different narratives that have been put into the public consciousness. You see people and they say, that's why these narratives get presented. They're not organic. The narrative of you have freedom of speech, but you don't have freedom of consequences. You've seen that. When people will get in trouble for social media posts and lose their jobs and they get demonized and whatnot. And people say, well, nobody's violating their freedom of speech. Nobody promised you freedom of consequences. That's not organic. That narrative was placed into the public consciousness. Now, when teeth actually get put into this, they will say what? No, no. The government's not violating your freedom of speech, but you don't have freedom of consequences. And see, people have already internalized that and they'll say, oh, yeah. Yeah, I've heard that for years. That's right. Everybody knows freedom of speech doesn't mean freedom of consequences. If you say the wrong thing, you go to prison. That's the consequence, but you can say it in your jail cell. See, you still have freedom of speech. These things get implanted into the public consciousness. And again, it always starts off with, oh, well, this is just a working definition. Nobody's going to go to jail or be fined for things that run in violation of this. But you see, obviously, if what's the point of having this if you're not ultimately heading to some form of enforcement, some form of punitive action for when you run afoul of this? Hell, you run afoul of it by asking, why does the government feel the need to adopt this and set up committees and do all of this in the first place? Because you're not allowed to say they have all of this influence over the government and politicians. But why does this document exist in the first place? Why is the governments running around, these different state governments running around adopting this and setting up committees to work with this? Why is that being done? You know, it's a rhetorical document, but on a long enough time scale, yeah, you're going to see that being a jumping. I believe you're going to see that as a jumping off point for European style speech laws when it comes to this sort of thing. And it's going to be pushed up the more outrageous Israeli policy becomes. That's why, because it's a rhetorical document, you see things addressed on all sides of the political scale. You know? And Israeli policy is indefensible. And so they're having, of course, to defend it. But if you ask again why they're doing that, that too runs afoul of the definition of anti-Semitism. Anyway, we're going to run along. We got to get into the Christian specific segment. No, we will not be discussing the Jews killing Jesus. So no worries about running afoul of the definition of anti-Semitism here. You know, to get in there, fill those pews. Let's get into this week's sermon at the Parish of the Patriots. Thought we'd open our discussion this week by posing the question, is it ever correct? Is it okay to question God? What I have found is the majority of believers do not believe you should ever question God. They will say something along the lines of, we're never supposed to question God. To question God is to show a lack of faith. Something along that line. I remember being young when I used to attend church as young, I would hear something along that lines that we're never supposed to question God. We're supposed to take it on blind faith. But is this actually correct? Is it okay to question God? Well, I think it's important. The short answer for me, just to give you the quick answer to that, I believe it's perfectly acceptable to question God. However, we have to be clear on what we're saying, what we're talking about when we say question God. What do we mean? For instance, a lot of times when somebody says, you know, somebody is quote unquote questioning God, they're not actually questioning God. They're blaming God. Perhaps something tragic happens in their life and they say, why did God allow this to happen? As if it was God who did, when God didn't even do that. Extreme example is somebody who had a loved one who was murdered or perhaps killed because of somebody's blatant negligence. And in dealing with their grief, and people are emotional in their grief, and you have to cut them some slack. You know, when people are grieving, they're not thinking rationally. But a lot of times in an extreme situation like that, somebody will sit there and their, you know, their faith is faltering, and they will say, why did God allow this to happen? Why did God do this? But you're asking the wrong individual, aren't you? The one who did it was the person who killed your loved one. It always comes back to that free will question, doesn't it? I've beat that horse to death, and I'm not going to really spend a lot of time on it. But as I've said before, and we have to always remember, we all have free will. Even people that use it poorly or use it even maliciously. But the way the system works that we live in this time, is everyone gets free will or no one does. You don't get to pick and choose. Well, I want God to give me free will, but nobody else should have free will. They're all idiots. It's not the way it works. Because other people have free will, other people make choices, and these choices can be harmful or even deadly to other people. But to sit there in such a situation and say, why did God do this? Why did God allow this to happen? Again, it's the wrong individual. It would be like if a complete stranger, you ran into a complete stranger in town and they attacked you, and you went home and went over to your neighbor's house and beat them up for doing that to you. They weren't even the one who did it. This would be blaming God for something that God had nothing to do with. It's not, I guess what I'm getting to is, that's a category. In such cases, that it's a category error. That person is not questioning God. They're blaming God, and God didn't have anything to do with it. Another example, I believe, of a category error of what is and is not actually questioning God is the non-believer, the atheist Spurg, if you would, who isn't actually questioning God. He's mocking God. He's mocking the Christian believer's faith. He may think he's attacking God or belittling God, but what he's actually doing, he's attacking your faith. He's mocking your faith. He frames it up as, see, because he doesn't believe, he's not afraid to mock God. But what he's actually, but it's not like he can affect God any. He's actually attacking you. He's attacking your faith. He's mocking you and your beliefs. He's not questioning God when the non-believer sits there and mockingly says, oh, well, if God is so omnipotent, then why does evil exist in this world? They always think things like this are clever, by the way. You ever notice? And they do not understand that this doesn't even rise to the level of kindergarten interpretation of how any of this works. They're like, why can't you explain this to me? Because I would have to start with such basic fundamental things that it would take days for us to even get up to what you're throwing out there, because you have like zero knowledge. You can't explain something, or it's very difficult to explain something when, okay, well, first we're going to have to start with these very, very principal things. You know, it would be like, explain these works of Shakespeare to me, but I don't know how to read and write. You know, well, we're going to have to start with how to read and write. This is the letter A. I mean, this is going to take a while. The fool comes at you, though, as though the fool always thinks that he's highly knowledgeable about something. And he bandishes this about this, what makes him a fool, and not simply somebody who is just ignorant. The fool, he honestly believes he's very knowledgeable about something that he's demonstrably knows nothing about. So, again, it is not questioning God. It is mocking God. These people who aren't actually striving to understand. And I think that's the distinction that's important to truly frame this up and understand it, is they're not actually seeking to understand it. They're mocking it. I was thinking about this concept the other day, and this is why I jotted this down. I thought we'd get into it today. This concept of questioning God. What does it look like? And is it correct? Because I do believe that when Christian believers have this just, I'm supposed to be a blind and never question God mentality, I don't believe that is correct. But when you start delving into this, you know, well, when is it incorrect to question God? most of the time, I think what you find is it's not actually questioning God. Now, I was thinking, well, if we think of God in the context of the Creator, you know, the one who created this world that we live in and this habitation, this temporal realm that we currently inhabit, if we view it in the context of God, the Creator, this perhaps makes it make more sense. What creator, what designer, somebody who makes something, if you come to that, if you're looking at this and you look at the designer and you're like, this is interesting, this is, how does this work? If you put yourself in the shoes of somebody who has designed something, a machine or a computer program, whatever, and somebody is looking at your creation and he looks at to you, the creator, and he says, well, this is incredible. How did you come up with this? What are the parameters? Why does this thing do what it is do? What it does? What did it do? What does this thing do but it do? Why does this thing do what it does? Why does it operate? Why does it form this function? What made you decide to come up with this creation? This is very interesting. Now, as a creator, if you put yourself in the shoes of the creator, you're going to be happy. Somebody has taken interest in what you've gone to the trouble to make. You're not going to be offended if somebody comes to you like that, if somebody's looking and they're interested in your creation. Most of the time, if you have ever been in a situation such as us, you will find that the creator, of course, people's personalities can be different, but by and large, you'll find that the creator is suddenly very happy. They're happy they have found somebody who has taken an interest in the work they've done and wants to understand why it does and what drove them, what motivated them to create this thing, to create this machine, to create this probe, whatever. The fact that somebody sees the value in it and really wants to understand it. So they want to understand. They're looking. They've taken an interest in the creation and they're asking, why does it do this? How did you come up with this? Why is it that it performs this function? Why is it that it does this thing? Why is it then when you input these things, this is what happens? As a creator, why would you be offended at that? Most people, if they're in that situation, they're thrilled to death. Somebody has actually noticed, not taken the creation for granted, and wants to know, but they're actually showing a genuine interest in the creation. Furthermore, as this applies to our faith, if you look at a creation, a created thing, an object, a machine, whatever, and you strive to understand it, oftentimes this tells you something about the person who made the decision or put in the work to create this thing. After all, if you're looking at a machine that performs a certain function, you have to ask, well, why did the creator of this decide this? We needed this. Why did they decide this was necessary? In other words, you can't help but to learn something about the creator via the creation, because what was their motivation? Why would they do such a thing? Nobody before thought we needed a machine that, I don't know, toasted bread or whatever. Why did this person decide it needed to be done? What was their motivation? You learn about the creator by the creation itself, by its form, its function, and why it even exists at all. Again, the creator is not offended that they're glad. They're glad that somebody has taken interest. Now, this is a far cry from what we referenced earlier, the mocker, the fool. Person who looks at the creation is like, this is stupid. Who came up with this? Imagine the designer is standing there and this idiot doesn't even know that's the person who created this. And they're like, oh, this is stupid. This is a piece of junk. Look how cheap it is. Huh, why would anyone think you needed that? Everybody knows you could just do this. This is stupid. In such a case, the creator is going to be offended. You would be, I would be. Because this idiot is standing there and doesn't appreciate any of the work that's been put into it. Much more so when the idiot is somebody who actually benefits from what has been created. And yet, in their ignorance, they sit there and mock. See, that person is not questioning. They're not taking an interest in the creation. They're not trying to understand how it works, why it works, the rules, the parameters, all of the thought and effort and work that went into it, figure out where the creator was coming. They're not. They're fools. They're just standing there mocking it as if they could do better, and they don't have the competence to tie their own shoes. See, this isn't quite... You see, it's... What we're trying to look at, what I'm trying to demonstrate here is what is questioning? Because you see, blaming is not questioning. Looking at mocking, ridiculing, being dismissive, this is not questioning. These are all just insulting behaviors. To truly question is to try to understand. And this gets to the heart of the matter of our faith. We spend our lives questioning. If it is wrong to question God ever, how are we ever going to learn about him? We spend, to grow in our faith, we essentially are constantly questioning God in the context of we're inquiring. We want to know. We're trying to understand. How are you going to understand if you don't question, if you don't ask? And who better to ask than the one who created it? For some reason, people always seem to lump it all together, you know? The fool mocker or the person blaming the wrong one, blaming, mocking, and genuine questioning, and they lump that all together. Oh, I can't question God. We just have to take it on faith that this is how it is. God doesn't want us to take it on faith, per se. He wants us to learn why, to understand it. Then it's easier to take it on faith because you understand why it works. Or at least you understand the motivation and the concept behind it. And then you can move forward and perform what you need to do, your tasks that you need to do, because you understand that it works. You may not understand all the details. None of us do in this life. You may not understand how every single function operates together to make your car work. But when you go out in the driveway and hop in it to run to town, you've got all the confidence and faith in the world that when you turn the key or push the button, I guess they all push the button now. All my stuff old. I have to turn the key still. When you turn the key or push the button, you're confident you're going to hear the engine run and you're going to back up and you're going to put it in drive, or again, if you're old like me, put in the clutch and put it in first, and you're going to go to town. You may not understand all the intricacies of valves opening and closing and gears turning together and lubrication. You may not understand all of those details, but you do understand the basic concept. You do understand enough that when you go get in it, you got confidence that you're fixing to drive to town. This makes it easier because you at least understand how it's supposed to work. If you turn the key and nothing happens, you're shocked. You're expecting to hear the engine turn over. We are constantly questioning, but not from the standpoint of blaming, not from the standpoint of mocking. We are legitimately and earnestly questioning. Why does this world work? I've said this so many times. I really believe one of the keys to understanding God is understanding the world we live in. The God's laws, in the context of the natural order of things, how this world functions and why it continues to function the way it does. And again, the world in this context being the creation, not the world is like society, what man has put on. Because one of the things I find incredible is that this world continues to work. You know, the creation continues to work, and it has all of these external pressures on it. And yet it continues to function. Things stay within the parameters. They'll get a little out, but then there's always a balancing effect that pushes things back in. A lot of times people will reference this without even understanding it. They will say, you know, you'll hear people use the term, you know, the pendulum. Things have gone too far this direction, and the pendulum is going to swing back. And people say that about society and such. But really, in a lot of ways, what they're referencing is the natural order's God's laws. In other words, the way the system, there is a recognition, even though they may not be a believer, there is a recognition that this world we live in is self-correcting. The system self-corrects. Things get pushed back to stay within, more or less within the parameters of what God designed it. And yet, it's under all these enormous external pressures. And yet, by and large, it still functions like it's supposed to. One of the things I've been thinking about here lately, and I'm still pondering this. Of course, I ponder a lot of things, as you might imagine. And I believe the narratives we're given, one of the things that they're working tirelessly to do is to hide the true nature of this world that we live in, the creation. You know, there are certain things I don't believe. And I believe these narratives are put out to hide the true nature of the world. Because the more we truly understand the creation, the world that we live in, the more it becomes undeniable that it was created by God. There was someone who, I always laugh and say, the most faith, you know, what would require the most faith is the belief that all of this that we experience somehow just came about by pure happenstance. You want to talk about a leap of faith? You want to talk about something that's completely illogical? But nevertheless, to get back on point, I do believe they hide the true nature of this world from us. They want us to be ignorant about the creation because the creation leads us to an understanding of the Creator. Just as an example of what I'm talking about, this term oil, fossil fuels. We always hear that term, fossil fuels. I make the claim, I think the term fossil, the idea that oil comes from decomposed dinosaurs. I honestly believe in my heart, and this is my personal opinion, but my honest belief is that is 100% unmitigated bullshit. I do not think oil comes from decomposed dinosaurs. I think that is a fairy tale they tell us, and I think we're told that in order to hide the nature of the creation. If oil is just something that is naturally created by the inner workings, the inner processes in the ground of the earth, the different things are being metabolized in a certain way in the earth's core, and oil is a byproduct created from that, then we don't have scarcity that we can be charged more and more money for. If people understood that oil is not a finite resource that we're going to run out of someday, but instead it is something essentially naturally created by the earth itself. You think of the billions and billions, and more than that, probably trillions of barrels of oil that have been pumped out of the ground throughout the history of the world. How many damn dinosaurs had to be decomposed for that? Whole lot more than 6 million. How many? Would it be like the whole place was just stacked full of dinosaurs? Because somehow, and I was a kid, I remember being told, you know, by 1980 or whatever, then 1990, we're going to run out of oil. We've reached peak oil. And they always say that, we've reached peak oil. But yet, we never run out. Why is that? It's kind of like the global warming and all the cities were going to be, they got our hopes up saying, you know, New York City was going to be underwater and that crap never came to pass. Why is that? We've been told over and over, it's peak oil, peak oil. Now, don't get me wrong, consumption can outpace what is produced by the earth. And so you do wind up with some scarcity, but it never goes away, does it? Amazing how that, you just stop for a minute and look at all the cars driving around. Look at all the planes flying around. All of this from quote unquote fossil fuels. And tell me that isn't bullshit. To get back on point. I have to do that a lot. Get back on point. The point being, why? You know, isn't it amazing that you have a situation where the earth produces this resource, which we just so happen to need at this, you know, that we're able to run all of these things on. And it just so happened to be provided. For centuries, it really wasn't a necessary thing. In fact, it would be seen as a nuisance. If you bought a bunch of land, you went back there in the back and there was an oil bubbling up out of the ground, you'd be like, oh crap, I can't plant crops here. I've got this useless black goo coming out of the ground. And yet, as time went on, we discovered the black goo turned out to be the energy to run societies on, these modern societies on. And yet it was all there waiting for us. It's all been produced. It's an amazing thing, isn't it? But yet we get told this fantasy story that it's made from decomposing dinosaurs. In this simple example, we understand the design concept. You know, in the year 1200 BC, no one needed oil, but it was there being produced by the earth. Why? And yet now we do. If you took away all the oil today, if it really did just disappear, oh, we're officially out of oil. Society all over the world would collapse. We're utterly dependent on this. And yet it was created, that function of the earth. Which, you see what I mean? You're questioning God and you look at these things and you understand. This function, it wasn't necessary in 1200 BC. And yet, when the foundations of the earth were laid, when God created the earth, he knew that at some point we would need this. This was going to be something useful for us. People in 1200 BC would find it a nuisance. I can't plant crops here. There's black goo. That ground's no good. There's black goo bubbling out of it. Now, it is a fundamental component for the societies we live in today. We have to have it, you know, to power these societies. And yet it was placed there. It was part of the design. Somebody questioning the design in 1200 BC would be like, you know, Lord, I don't understand. Why'd you make this? What purpose does the black goo serve? And yet today, we can't imagine our lives without it. You see what I'm saying? By just this, understanding this manner in the world that we live in, you see why they create this false narrative. Oh, well, it's just because those dinosaurs that just so happened to be created, they all decomposed and turned into this. And that narrative is an attempt to obfuscate, to hide the nature of the world. Because when hiding the nature of the world we live in, they hide the nature of God from us. They want us to believe that we're just randomly here. We're randomly created from different things. And you start from all of that randomness and molecules randomly came together and somehow became living things that randomly evolved and crawled up out. It's obvious gibberish. But if you understand the nature of the world, it becomes, I believe there's even more fundamental things than this that they're hiding from us because they do not want us to understand the true nature of the world we live in. Because if we understand the nature of the world we live in, then it becomes undeniable. They can't promote their stupid narratives about, oh, we all just randomly appeared here in the universe and evolved from fish and monkeys and all of the rest of it. If we truly understood the nature of the world we live in, of the creation, there's no way you could deny the Creator God. I think one of the greatest gifts God gives us is this, you know, our own nature. Remember, we're created in the image of God, and He has given us this inquisitive mind, you know, wanting to understand the world we live in, the world around us, wanting to understand how things work. I can't imagine going through life just not questioning anything. Don't question it. Don't try to figure out why or what for. How dare you? I mean, how are you going to learn anything? If you went to take a class to learn how to do something and they put the materials around you and gave you some basic instructions, but one of the rules of the class is you're not allowed to ask any questions because that's disrespectful. You wouldn't expect to learn much, would you? And yet, as believers, we understand that our purpose here is to learn. That's why we're here. That's why we're given this time to prepare, to learn, to get ready. Get ready. This is the prequel. I always approach this like this is the prequel. We get hung up on it because this is all we know right now. But this is the prequel. You go through the whole story and you're like, well, that was an interesting story. That, and then somebody tells you, hey, tell you, that's just the prequel. The real story starts next. It's like, what? Yes, this is just the buildup. We're here to learn. We're here to learn. We're here to grow. We're here to mature. We're here to understand, to at least grasp as much as we can so that we're ready when the real story starts. And you're not going to do that if you don't ask any questions. How are you going to learn anything? I don't understand how anybody as a believer, as a Christian believer, could be satisfied with the idea of never asking any questions. I don't know how to even categorize that. Fear of what you might learn? Fear? Afraid to learn something? Intellectual laziness? I'm just happy right where I'm at, and I don't want to learn nothing else. I'm just not going to question. I'm just going to say everything is God's will, and just take it at that, and just keep plodding through life. I don't know how anybody could be satisfied with that. It's fine to question God. Heck, that's the whole integral part of what we're supposed to be doing, which is learning about Him. And you can't learn about somebody if you don't ask any questions. Anyway, nothing wrong with questions. Be sure you're actually asking. You just actually are interested. You're not accusing, you're not blaming, and certainly you shouldn't be mocking or ridiculing the creation. You should be seeking to understand, you know, asking why. This is why we're here. This is an integral part of what we're doing. And as such, of course, there's nothing wrong with questioning God. It's actually a big part of how we grow our faith and what we're supposed to be doing. We're going to wrap up on that note. I appreciate you joining us today. I hope you got something out of the whole show. Hope you got something out of the Christian specific segment, especially. I do appreciate y'all that join me for the show each week. I really do appreciate y'all taking the time that you do get something out of it. It gives me a sense of accomplishment. Like there is a point to it. So again, thank you very much for joining us. And hopefully we'll see you once again here next week for the Parish of the Patriots.